It truly is a privilege to share with you this morning. I do want to give a disclaimer. So, I'm not here to give you any dogma or to tell you that the stories I'm about to share you are things you should do too, okay? These are going to be my stories. These are some of the things that I've had to go through in process, that I've had to go through to discover enlightenment, and then how shifts came into my world. And I know coming from my past, and I am blown away that I get to be here. It is truly an honor. And it's also another push to the edge for me, too. Because I've always preached in circles that are more Christian-based. And so to be welcomed here is an honor. And I do want to honor you. So that's why I give the disclaimer, all right? But I'm going to share some of the journey. So the question I'm going to ask rhetorically, because it's a question to me, how do you go from being an ordained evangelical fundamentalist Baptist minister to standing here today at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Midland, Texas? How does that happen? Okay? All right? Because that's for me, okay? That's the journey I've had to make, to come to the place where I can be free. So how do you travel from that point to this point? Well, first off, I want to talk about, just lay out a model. It's called experiential learning model. Everyone familiar? You're living, right? Yes. So this week I had the honor of doing 2 days of training a lot of our folks and our staff how to do the XY zone. The XY zone is all about experiential learning model, okay? We're not like the chalkboard and step 1 through 10. We don't do that. We're about looking at life and experiencing it and backing up and say, what happened there? So in the experiential learning model, you have concrete experience, reflective observation, abstract conceptualization, and then active experimentation. That's the fun part. Concrete experience, reflective observation, abstract conceptualization, active experimentation. That looks like process. That looks like what it takes to come to enlightenment. And that's what looks like shifts. And the shifts aren't that everything around you change, okay? It's that the way you see everything around you changes. And that's where the magic happens. So, are you ready? Here we go. You know that you can't help the families you're born into? I know that's deep. I hope you can track with me here. So I was born into a belief system that shaped my values, my sense of worth. It gave me purpose and something to believe in and to belong to that seemed bigger than just me. And that's a profound thing to connect to. These systems of belief flowed into my real-life concrete experiences. I was living out a reality that I knew to be true, and my view of God fit perfectly within my set of beliefs. Isn't that awesome? Yeah. It is in those real concrete experiences that process happens. So what I want to say is we can't help what we're poured into at birth. We're not in control of that. I saw the world in a very binary way. It was either this or that. It was dualistic, up, down, on, off, right, left, okay, black, white, whatever, however you want to put that. And Richard Rohr calls it the practice of elevator theology, okay? So elevator theology is you're either going up or you're going down, all right? And boy, I could preach the sermons on going to heaven and what you better do so you don't go to hell one day, all right? So, and I sincerely believe that. I didn't do it. And I didn't preach those things cynically. I believe there really was those places. So I sincerely believed and I practiced and did so in the truest and most authentic manner possible. I believed in the process of that belief system. And so in genuine sincerity of my heart and soul, I practiced a particular belief system wholeheartedly. To the point where I moved to the Chicago region, went to seminary and got degreed and became a minister. And we moved to Canada, worked at a church, married, had our first kid. That's the journey. So I did those belief systems wholeheartedly, that is, until I could no longer practice them wholeheartedly. Because what happened is you start having, what do we call those? The first step of experiential learning? Concrete experiences. When concrete solidifies, have you tried to punch it or hit it with your head? It hurts. And I began to deal with a sense of emptiness, a sense of hollowness, a sense there's got to be something more than this. I remember sitting in one of the largest churches in the country as I was in Bible college, where we'd have 18,000 to 20,000 in services every week. And I was in the inner city of Chicago doing ministry. And I remember a sweet Puerto Rican family who I shared with them my faith, and they chose to go through the process of what we had to be a part of that system. And then I remember them coming to church with me. I remember them walking down an aisle. I remember them going up into the baptistry and getting baptized. And I remember sitting with them, and while I was sitting with them a week or two later, I remember feeling, is that all there is to this? I don't know, it was just a question. And that's where it starts. Is that all there is? Now what? I began asking questions and found out very quickly that this is a good way to be told that I was a snake in the grass and I was playing with heresy. You can't ask questions. It's a dangerous thing. And then it starts getting lonely because you're asking questions about theology, and in retrospect you realize those questions I was asking was causing people to not feel safe. I was questioning their security. I was questioning the common connection that brought us together because they were belonging systems and belief systems. I heard Guru Singh in Southern California said, you do know belonging systems or belief systems is BS, right? I just laughed. I thought that was hilarious. Anyhow. That wasn't in my notes, I'm sorry. I can recall hearing my wife, Teresa, declare that she will no longer be going to church. And if that meant she was going to burn in hell one day, then so be it. Because she could no longer live what felt inauthentic to her true self. She said, I have to stop. I can recall that I could no longer hold on to most of the core teachings of the belief systems and realize that this letting go of how I viewed God felt like I was betraying something. It felt like I was practicing atheism. And in a sense, I was. I had to stop believing in a God that would torture humanity for eternity and kill his son to satisfy some cosmic need for judgment. I just couldn't stay there. So in this atheistic, a/theistic state, where I was bouncing between, I think I believe in a God, to, oh, screw it all, to, I think there's, you know, have you been there? Yeah. Are you still there? Yeah. Okay. So I was practicing atheism. And it was helping me, but scary at the same time. I came to a place of seeing that I was letting go of unrealistic perspectives, but in the initial departure, it felt like I was leaving everyone and everything I'd ever known to be true. Kind of climbing out on a limb and pulling the saw out and doing this. And that's a process, and I'm not going to go into all those stories. We're talking decades. I won't bore you with the theological stuff. There's just mounds of it, though. And what I found is this stuff, it's like the fibers in fabric. It's all interwoven. And what I found is it's still woven in me. It's still there. And I thought you had to, like, pull all the fibers apart. And then one day I had this visualization of, no, that's not it. It gets pulled apart and rewoven. Because it all does belong. But the most, one of the most recent moments was June of 2014. And this is where we came into our 28th year of marriage, and we came to the biggest marital crisis of our lives. And in June of 2014, my son graduated from high school, and my wife and I hit a wall. And it was like, maybe we need to separate. We need to consider divorce, maybe. And my whole world was crashing down. And so was hers. We just knew whatever it was, it couldn't keep going the way it was going. What we didn't know is it was directly entangled with our theology that we thought we had worked through. A little thing called patriarchy. You familiar with that? Yeah. I didn't realize I was role-playing as a husband. I was being the spiritual leader of the home. I always saw things I thought she needed to do to improve herself, so I was her there to help her. You know how horrible that is? I found out through a lot of therapy. We had to go through individual therapy, then we went through marriage therapy. My wife found a feminist theologian in Southern California who took her on. Matter of fact, that's where my wife's at right now. She's in Las Vegas with her feminist theologian friend to catch up. I didn't realize how those entanglements impact everything. It's the way you see everything. And so Teresa and I had to walk in that, sit with it, the chaos, the mystery, the uncertainty, the unknown. All I knew, and I'm reading stuff like Living Buddha, Living Christ, Thich Nhat Hanh, and I'm going, God, this guy's got something going on here. Then I'm tuning into Richard Rohr, and I'm learning about mindfulness and meditation and contemplation. And I'm finding myself not trying to fix what I thought was broken because I wasn't smart enough to even know it was broken. I just had to sit with the pain. I had to sit with the loss. I had to let what could die, die. I had to grieve the fact that it would never be the same again. And that if our marriage needed to evaporate and go away, that might have been the best thing for us, and it's okay. None of us like death. None of us like to grieve. And that was hard. But you know what? We just celebrated 31 years last month. Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know, she may not be clapping so hard, but... No, where we're at, though, is we went through a death. And in the Christian tradition, we believe in a resurrection. But you can't have a resurrection until you have a death. And it's not natural to want to let yourself die. You know that, right? We fight like the Dickens to keep things alive. So it went against all nature to let that die and to sit with it. And then the miracle for us was... 2 years into that, we started talking again. I mean, really talking. You know what we found? We had the same language. We had the same meanings behind the words we were using. Amazing. Our dialect was even the same. That's a universal miracle when that happens. Our therapist says, yeah, that was a lot of work too. But we also recognize there was something bigger going on there too, to draw us, to change.